We mentioned this before, but we're doing Back to the Future Part 2 this week. It's a departure from the usual format of Mike at the Movies, because I have seen this movie.
Yes.
Not only have I seen this movie, it is one of my favorite movies. But considering this week, actually on Wednesday, is the day that Marty flies into the future, right? Mm-hmm. It felt like a fitting Mike at the Movies to do.
Absolutely. It couldn't be more timely.
So there's a bunch of stuff this
for a movie
week.
Made in 1990.
Exactly. 1989. So it even fits in the usual 80s rule.
Okay.
At least that's what IMDb tells me. So again, we're not breaking rules here.
All right, November 1989. You're right.
There you go. So you have done an incomparable about Back to the Future?
About all the movies. It's a pretty old one. It's number 41. But people can check that out.
This was back when The Incomparable did much broader topics.
Yes, back when I didn't realize that we would be nearing 300 episodes.
Let's talk about movies today.
We did an episode about Joss Whedon. Like all Buffy the Vampire Slayer, I could do 10 episodes about Buffy alone. And we did one episode that was just everything Joss Whedon has done. Yeah, smart. We didn't know what we were doing. But yes, we did it. We did a live episode in the Mackerel podcast room, which got increasingly stuffy as it goes. So we get a little punchy at the end. But it was like me and Dan Frakes and Lex Friedman and Serenity and Dan. I think that was who the crowd was. But it's number 41. It's called But Your Kids Are Gonna Love It. So you can check that out.
And this is, you know, this is a great week because this week there is stuff everywhere about Back to the Future. Like, there are lots of things. There are lots of companies that are bringing out awesome stuff. I'm really excited for what the week's going to bring as a massive fan of this series. I love Back to the Future. Back to the Future and Back to the Future 2 are in my top list of movies of all time. I love these movies so much. Back to the Future 2 was always my favorite as a kid because of the 2015 scene. There was something about it. It just grabbed me, and I loved it so much. Over time, though, part one and part two have jostled as which is my favorite of the series, and I'm going to talk about a little later on why that is, because it was only up until about 6 months ago that I always thought that part two was my favorite, and I think that Back to the Future one is my favorite now.
That's a good choice.
But and I'll talk about what it is. There's a specific part that, you know, anybody that knows the movie probably knows what I'm referring to. But we should do as we always do, kind of go through this chronologically. I don't have as detailed notes as usual because I know this movie so well, right? That I didn't really think it was necessary. And plus, I want to talk a little bit more kind of about the movie and kind of in the way that it has influenced a bunch of things and how interesting it is to me now, watching it with the context of it was talking about right now.
Right.
Which I like. But I did want to mention, listener Tom sent in a link to an Amazon.com listing for the 30th anniversary trilogy box set that they're selling. And there's a video that you can watch, which is an ad for it. And it's very, very clever because they are basically saying in the ad to show you the future that we would have had if Marty and the Doc hadn't messed with it. So what they're saying is, like, we don't have all of the stuff that's in this because they messed with the timeline. I thought that was very clever. I like that.
I wonder if listener Tom is Tom Wilson, who plays Biff in Back to the Future.
Probably.
We'll just say it is.
We'll say it is.
Tom, last name withheld.
That's headcanon right there.
That is my headcanon. Yeah, that's right.
So, So one of the consistent themes that I'm going to talk about for what I love about this movie is the way that it is intertwined with the first movie. And I love that this movie begins with the end scene of the first movie, which obviously they reshot because the actress that plays Jennifer didn't renew. Like, she didn't come back.
For some reason, they Lauren and I were talking about this when we watched this last night, and she says, well, given how little she has to do in this movie, and it's Elizabeth Shue, they get to replace her, it's got to be that she wasn't available. Because even if they decided, oh no, she's not a very good actress and now we need her, she's basically not in the movie.
I think it was money related.
So it must have been something like that.
Yeah, which I believe is the same for Crispin Glover as well.
Yeah, Crispin Glover. Well, he's also a weirdo, so he may just have not wanted to come back. But he definitely didn't come back. The first movie made a lot of money, and then they see, you know, Steven Spielberg is lining up to produce this, you know, two movies back to back. They shot two and three together, and I could see how somebody might try to hold out for a bigger payday. I could sort of see that. I think it hurts the movie because I really love the original, and this is a recreation of it here. Instead of it really being the same scene as the previous movie, it's this not quite the same because it's Elizabeth Shue and she's got like a wig to match the girl from the other movie, and her hair is really weird. I don't know. It's too bad because I have so much goodwill because of loving the first movie so much, and the opening scene it feels a little sour to me because it is absolutely a re-recorded version. It's almost like you're watching kind of the stage version of Back to the Future here at the beginning.
It is funny that I love it for that, and you, because I love that they just did it. I just love because they didn't even need to do it, right? Because they start this movie with no explanation. Like, you had to have seen Back to the Future 1. They could have just as easily started with them in the car, right? Like, in the future, having just gone, you know, or start with Biff looking up as the DeLorean flies away. But they recreate that scene, which I mean, I can see why you wouldn't like it for the reason that you mentioned. It's a very good point. But I love it because of that. And like, one of my long-running theme, one of the things that I'm going to mention it now because we're talking about it now, but I think Back to the Future 2 is the most sequel-y sequel ever in all of the right ways. It is like the most perfect sequel because it like reuses elements and scenes from the first movie and is completely intertwined with it. Like, it is, for me, I think, a fantastic achievement of editing, the way that they put this together.
I agree. There's some amazing stuff in here. I would say, yeah, we'll get to it. I think you're right. Biff is the reason this scene is replayed, because you need to see that he's...
They have to have him look up and see them all go away. But it could have started there if, you know, they could have done it that way.
Yeah, it's fine. A conversation we had last night was at the end of Back to the Future, it's a joke. It's a great ending. They say goodbye to the doc. Marty's back. Everything's okay. He's with his girl. They're going to go to the lake or whatever. It's all great.
Yep.
And then there's a great joke that ends the movie, which is he returns. He's got to go to the future. They're going to be married and their kids are in trouble. And where we're going, we don't need roads. And it flies and it's the end. It's like, yeah, that was the greatest ending ever. And then you do a sequel and you're like, oh man, well, we got to pick it up from there. And it's interesting that I feel the movie kind of struggles for the first half hour because it's trying to live up to the joke at the end of the first movie. And I'm sure it would have been, they could have told a better story from the beginning if they didn't have to kind of hit all the notes that are mentioned in that last scene. Because it's just kind of funny that they by making such a great last scene of the first movie, they made their jobs for the sequel much harder.
This is so interesting.
You have to deal with Jennifer, and you have to deal with Biff. You have to deal with the kids. There have to be kids. The kids have to be involved, and they have to be in trouble. And that sort of, like, they might have made different choices, but they have to live up to the joke from the first, which is a great joke at the end of the first movie. And it just changes the trajectory because they have to live up to it.
Then we get the fantastic theme, the Back to the Future theme, which I love so much.
It's great.
Beautiful. Who scored this?
It's Alan Silvestri, I think.
Yes, you're right. You're right. So Silvestri,
It's John Williams-esque in a way, but it's Alan Silvestri. But it's got that same kind of soaring orchestral. You know it if you've seen the Back to the Future movies. You know that theme.
So obviously we go to the future, right? What is one of my most
favorite...
We're
in 2015!
Yes, the impossible future of 2015. And this is probably... I mean, it's mainly for nostalgic reasons, but this is my favorite scene of any movie ever. Because since being a little boy, I have just been obsessed with this scene. I love this scene when they arrive in the future. Mainly the scene from when Marty walks out into Hill Valley, into the town square. That's what I love. I love that scene so much. before that, hilarious to me how they just put Jennifer in the trash, right? Oh. She's just, we'll deal with you
again,
later. Like,
again,
we don't
want
you
in,
now.
We don't want you in the movie, so we're going to put you to sleep and stick you over here with the garbage.
It's great.
And we'll get you, and not leave you in the car. And because Biff is going to steal it, so or whatever the reason is, but it's just because you need to be kidnapped. It's so bad because again they don't need her, but she was in the first movie or at the end of the first movie, so they've got to do something with her. And that's not the only time this happens. They dump her on the front porch later too. Oh, it's not good. But then the doc has to go. He's going to delay Marty's son so that Marty can take his place. And he basically says, and actually this is a laugh out loud funny joke, which is, he says, Marty, you look just like your son now. You need to go out there, go to the 80s diner and buy yourself a Pepsi. Here's a 50.
Yeah.
That yeah. kills me. That just kills me. Here's a 50.
Yeah, it's a very subtle joke, but it's excellent.
I'm drinking a Coke Zero right now, not a Pepsi Perfect, but I'm sure from the perspective of 30 years ago, both are equally ridiculous.
Pepsi are releasing Pepsi Perfect this week.
I know.
But like in very limited numbers.
Like 3,000 of them for 50. Yeah. I think it's $50. I think it's 50. It will cost you 50 to get a Pepsi Perfect.
I wish I could get my hands on one easy. I want to buy everything that comes out this week. I'm hoping and praying that Nike release on general release the shoes.
The self-lacing shoes?
They don't even need to be self-lacing.
They just need to look like that? The boot shoes?
Because they did them for charity, didn't they, a few years ago?
I think so.
They did. So, and they were like $1,000.
So Marty walks out, and here it is, the world of tomorrow, which is, it is a wonderful moment of like, well, what's the future going to be like? Yeah. And here it is. It's bright and sunny, and there's a movie theater that's showing Jaws 14 or whatever it is.
19.
Yeah.
Now it's really personal or something like that.
It's really,
it's
really personal.
Yeah, really, really personal. Yeah. So I wanted to just, I have a list here of some of the key advancements that 2015 brings, mm-hmm. and I would like us to assess them.
Yes.
All cars are flying.
Well, most cars are flying, and they're selling conversions for your old wheelies to be flying cars. That's actually an ad that I think Biff is involved somehow in the automotive industry at this point, right?
Then it's Goldie Wilson.
Oh, it's Goldie. Goldie the Third. That's right. And they're doing the conversions of your old wheeled cars to be the flying cars.
3D movies, which, funnily enough, in 2015 are maybe not as popular as they were in earlier years, but
yeah,
but they are there, right? So that's one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the weird one, right, is my assumption. You're going to have to explain this to me. The Cubs.
The Cubs. Sure. So there's a great gag in the movie where, and it's during Wednesday during the day, which is not right because it's a news alert that the Cubs have won the World Series. And World Series games are played at night.
Not in the future.
Even on the weekend, but so they missed the cynicism of that, but it's an announcement. Maybe it's just delayed. They won the night before, but it's the Cubs have won the World Series. Also, the World Series isn't going to be for another week because they've stretched out the playoffs a lot longer since 30 years ago. But the joke is the Cubs, the Chicago Cubs in Major League Baseball. Are one of the original National League teams. They've been playing since the early 20th century, since the National League came into being in like 1902 or something like that. And they haven't played in the World Series since 1945, and they haven't won the World Series since 1908, I believe. So the joke is the Cubs won the World Series. So that's joke number one, because the Cubs haven't even been in the World Series in all this time. What's interesting is the Cubs are currently in the National League Championship Series against the Mets. So there is, as we record this, there is still a chance the Cubs will be in and maybe even win the World Series in 2015. Wouldn't that be amazing? The other joke is that they beat Miami. And there's a picture of like an alligator. So they're like the Miami Gators or something. And this is funny, and I had to explain this to my kids last night. Because there's a major league team in Miami now, the Miami Marlins. They're in the National League like the Cubs, so they couldn't meet in the World Series. But it is there. The joke is, in 1985 or 1989, when this movie came out, there was no Major League Baseball team in Florida. So that's a joke that has come true and made it less funny because it's like against Miami. Well, that's in the wrong league, but yeah, that's a team, but it wasn't a team in 1989. So there's a couple little baseball jokes there. And what's funny is the writer of this movie is a St. Louis Cardinals fan who are actually the enemies of the Chicago Cubs. And he was saying how, when the Cubs and the Cardinals were playing in the previous round of the postseason here, he was saying, well, I would really rather the Cardinals win, but if the Cubs win, I'll look like a genius. So that's still active as we record this.
Haveline goes into cars.
Isn't that just like oil or something?
Yeah, it's some kind of thing. But
yeah, I was struck that there's still sort of a gas station. There's like a robot gas station and all of that. And I was a little surprised that they hadn't like made them nuclear cars or electric cars or something like that.
The way I take this is it's alternative fuel. And so I give it a tick because we now have electric. So we'll, you know, a half tick.
All right.
Bionic implants is another one.
Yeah.
I don't think we have those.
Well, we have lots of, you know, we have people with cochlear ear implants and they're working on like artificial retinas, and there are people with very sophisticated prostheses and things like that. They don't have like, because with Biff, it's like he's got bionic or Griff or whatever. His bionic implants are on the fritz, and he's like, yeah, he's like a cyborg practically, and it seems normal.
Hoverboards. So there is a thing called hoverboards now, but it's not the same thing.
No.
It's just a smart marketing thing, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah.
It's the right time if you're going to have a product, call it hoverboard. It's kind of interesting, but you know.
Flying cars and floating skateboards are not things that we have.
Video games that you don't control with your hands. That's all we know, but it's what the kids mention.
I love that scene where they're in the 80s diner, which I have to say, actually, I think they nailed. There's an article I read this week that said that they knew, even when they were making the first movie, they knew they were making a bit of 80s nostalgia, that Back to the Future is itself very 80s, aggressively 80s in a way that you wouldn't do if you were trying to make it sort of a little more timeless, but that they knew that since the movie was about looking at the 50s with nostalgia, that making the 80s be heightened was actually a good idea, because then you get the contrast. And I think as time goes on, it also becomes about 80s styles, and it becomes its own period piece. And I thought that was interesting. They nail in Back to the Future 2, they nail the 80s diner. Like, yeah, there's stuff that's not in there. But like the sign is very 80s. It's like, I think they did from the perspective of 1989, they did a pretty good job of saying this is really 80s. And one of the things in there is a video game thing where Marty plays it, and it's a shooter thing, which is totally a preview for Back to the Future Part 3, which there are several of in this to set that up. But the kids are disgusted that you have to like hold the controls and stuff, which is very, you know, Kinect and stuff like that. That's I think that's a good one.
And the last one that I wanted to point out was when, and this comes up later in the movie as well, when the clock tower guy approaches Marty and asks him to donate money to save the clock tower, he has a tablet-like device in his hand with a fingerprint reader on it to debit the money. It's Apple Pay is what I'm going to go with there.
Yeah, it's Apple Pay, except that he's got his own terminal instead of like
a personal
like Marty.
Device.
Yeah, right. Exactly right. Or something that a person would tap. Instead, it's just put your thumb on it. So it's not quite, but close. The cab is the other one. The cab, when Biff gets a cab ride to Marty's house, is that it? Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. And it's like $130 or something is the cab fare, because that's the running gag of everything's being, all the inflation that's happened, which didn't happen, actually. But the cab driver has essentially, it's like a wireless pay terminal like you used to see and still sometimes see in cabs. A lot of them have them built in now, but or they use smartphones. But that's a totally like, that's the technology. The only difference is that he thumbs the price instead of like again tapping a smartphone or running a card. They did a good job with that.
They did, and I mean, I love all of the, I love everything about this scene. I love it all.
What they don't get is like computers and the internet.
Yeah. Or smartphones or nothing. Yeah,
well,
nothing.
That's exactly it. Smartphones, or the internet, they're still... Another thing that made me cackle throughout this movie is its reliance on the newspaper. Although, to be fair, USA Today is still being published.
Yep.
And if you're in one of our fine American hotel rooms, you may receive the USA Today at your door whether you want it or not. So there is a 2015 USA Today edition. I wonder if they'll have a special logo on Wednesday.
I hope they do just a wrap. They just do like a wrap around the paper. That would be really cool if they did.
But that would be funny. But
Universal
it is,
should pay for that.
But there are newspapers as information sources, and it's a motif. You know, they need it in the 50s too. But it's just kind of funny that's the thing. Just like we joke about this on The Incomparable, we were talking about the Flash TV show and how one of the plot points in the first episode of The Flash, so I'm not really spoiling anything, it's in the very first episode, but there's basically a newspaper from the future. And I could tell that they really wanted it to be a newspaper front page, but the producers knew it, and it's supposed to be from like 2025 or something. And the producers were like, this kind of can't be a newspaper, can it? So it's like a web page from the future. It's like a newspaper site from the future, which I'm not sure how that would work. Like, does the HTML change when the timeline shifts? I don't know how that works.
How far in the future?
I think it's 10 years in the future.
You could go in
the
newspapers. You could still go in newspapers.
Yeah, but it's just, they like hedged it. It looks kind of like a newspaper, but it also looks sort of digital, and it's the same thing. So anyway, there are newspapers used throughout, and the information technology kind of revolution is the thing that most sci-fi stuff trying to project our future didn't see. Although I did, so when Biff and his crew come in and are harassing Marty Jr. and Marty, and then later when they're having the hoverboard chase and all of that, I did turn to my daughter, who is 14, and say, wow, teenagers in 2015 are awful. And she was like, yep.
Aw. My main annoyance with the first act of this movie is the exposition. Like, for example, when Biff is telling Marty, who Biff believes to be Marty McFly Jr., Marty's kid, about the fact that, you know, your dad, Marty McFly Sr., who flushed his life down the toilet. Like, every character has it explained to them what their parents are like. And, like, later on, when they're in the McFly home and Lorraine is explaining to Marty's daughter about the fact that, you remember your father?
As you know already, daughter, your father had this history. And on that day when he had that accident and he broke his hand, and that really changed people call this the as you know Bob phenomenon, right? Which is like dialogue that is just a clunker because it's exposition.
Yeah.
You're telling somebody who already knows things that they don't need to hear because the audience needs to hear it. And there's a whole lot of that in because they're doing all that. Look, I like their projections of the future. I think that's fun, even though I don't love the beginning of this movie. I think that part is fun. But it becomes very clear, I think, when you step back a little bit, that the first like 40 minutes of this movie is really dedicated to putting all the pieces in place so that they can go back and play with the original movie. And you know, when they get to that point, it's kind of great, but they got to do it. They do a lot of work to get it set up first. And it's not as fun to watch the setup as it is to watch it pay off.
They got to do it. And I think they do it the best way that they can, but it is kind of annoying. Like they try, you can see they're trying hard, like to set it up so they can deliver the exposition, but
they're trying really hard.
Yeah. But there's no way around it. If you're going to do it, you just got to do it. This scene, so this is in the Cafe 80s scene when this exposition begins, but this is also when another long-running theme in this movie begins, which I think is great. They do a really, really good job with the special effects to show the same actor in the same scene twice. Watching this movie, there is no scenario where it doesn't look real to me.
No, I mean, you can tell that it's lockdown camera and all those things, but Robert Zemeckis, I mean, if there's one thing that is all part of Robert Zemeckis' career, it is trying to creatively use technology. And you know, we can argue that Zemeckis sometimes seems to make movies because he wants to use the technology rather than using them to solve problems.
Like Polar Express, for example.
Well, right, exactly. And when, you know, there's a scene in Contact where, well, and Forrest Gump is the biggest example. I mean, he followed these movies with Forrest Gump, which where they put Tom Hanks into historical footage, right? Mm-hmm. And that was what that movie was. This movie is all about split screen, multiple actors or same actor playing different roles.
Yep.
And there's a scene with Biff, old Biff and young Biff in a car where the camera is panning and they're handing things back to each other. And you can tell it's like, on one level, it's really showy. Like, look, I handed this book to him, where you're like, you're showing off. On another level, it's like, how did he hand that book to him? And that, and it makes it seem more real at the same time as it's sort of calling out that it's being clever. But anyway, in Contact, he did something similar where he's like panning through glass that isn't there anymore or through a mirror and stuff like that. He does this in his movies, but it's very impressive here.
And then when you talk about the different actors, Michael J. Fox, his performance as the other members of his family is incredible. Like when he plays Marty McFly Jr., it's like a different person. I find anyway that I can watch this and I know who is who. Just by the way that they act, I think he does a great job of it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're very brief, and it's got a little of the gimmicky feel, like it's, you know, the Clumps or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's like he'll play every part, but it's a gag, and it's obviously him. But they're differentiated. I mean, they're very broad characters. This is, I mean, one of the problems I have with this future stuff is that it's so broad. All of it is so broad. Marty Sr. is a loser, and Marty Jr. is an idiot, and it is what it is. But
time I watch this movie, I always forget and always take great joy in Marlene McFly, so Marty's daughter. I always forget that Michael J. Fox dresses up as a young girl in this movie, and every single time I just burst into laughter, because he does, it's so funny, like just the way that she saunters down the stairs and looks around, like when they go to the home later on, it gets me every time. I love it. But before we leave the clock tower area, I do love about this movie that it exists throughout, that they reenact scenes from the first movie, so like they reenact the chase. Yes. And you know, like later at the end of the movie, they reenact the manure going into Biff's car.
Uh-huh.
I love that. I think this is what I was saying, like it's the most sequel-y sequel.
Yes. Yeah, I mean the hoverboard chase is a reenactment. Right down to grabbing the back bumper of a floating car in this case, right?
And then Biff says there's something, like, so this is old Biff, right? Who was Biff back in, you know, back in the past, it's the older guy. There's something very familiar about this.
Yeah. Yep.
Which is great. It's great.
I agree.
Here's a future thing. The McFly house is controlled with fingerprint entry and voice to turn on the lights. It's HomeKit, Jason.
Yeah, and we hear computer voice a lot for voice interaction, but it sounds like Stephen Hawking's voice instead of Siri or something like that. But it is. There's voice control. Although I did laugh that they have a smart door, but it has no doorknob. Which is, it's funny because, you know, it makes it more futuristic, but really no doorknob.
Why do you need a doorknob? But I mean, they do that so Jennifer can't escape, right?
That's
why that's there. And obviously fax machines.
Yes, the fax machines are hilarious.
Marty is fired by fax and it arrives all over the house, which is just so funny. And then we get into, so, you know, at this point, we're back in 85 now, right? So they've done everything they need in 2015. We go back to 85.
Right. But it turns out that Biff has changed the timeline. So they go back to a dark, terrible, dystopian 1985. Marty can't believe it's 1985, but it is.
This is the bit of the movie that over time has tainted the way that I feel about Back to the Future 2.
Yeah.
It's too dark.
It's way too dark. It goes on way too long. It's really unpleasant. I mean, they're setting up the stakes of, oh my God, I can't believe it, but it is so dark and it is so long. And this is a movie where we're supposed to be having fun. And like, I get it. All it really should be is like, oh no, they changed it. Things are wrong. Biff's in charge now. My dad is dead. I got to go back. It does not.
There are elements which they can do and it's fine. But the fact that there are kids driving around shooting everyone. You know, yeah, like, that's
and
not needed.
The whole town is a wasteland, and Marty's, I mean, Marty's mom is a recurring motif in these movies, and so to see her with the plastic surgery and all of that, but it goes on so long, and there's that painful, like, argument where she completely... you know, basically Biff says, but I won't pay money to your kids and they'll be destitute. And she says, okay, well, I'll stay. And it's your problem, where it's this is like horrible abusive relationship. And it's mm-hmm. like, guys, yeah, okay. But it, this is supposed to be a fun movie and it's not fun. I agree with you. I think that is the worst segment of this movie. It didn't need to be this. Once the timeline is messed up and Biff messed it up to benefit himself, that's all we need, really. I think. Yeah.
There are still some good parts in this act. This, I guess this is the second act, right?
Yeah.
But there are still some good parts in it, but the overall feeling of it is
it's
not...
It's icky.
Yeah.
Like, it's icky.
You know, this is where we get the alternate 1985 explanation, which I love. I love that scene. And I like the yes. kind of the chase, right? So once Marty... is on to Biff, like I like that part, right? So when they're having that confrontation in the room,
right.
And then he chases him up to the roof, and then he jumps off the roof and he's on the DeLorean.
Yeah, like, I like feel like that could have been the whole thing. Was Marty and Doc come, and Doc's got to go check out his house, and Marty sees that Biff is in charge, confronts Biff. Biff's like, oh geez, they warned me you would be coming, and he sees his mom and it's all horrible, and he goes to the roof, and Doc picks him up because Doc's found out that his timeline has changed too, and they go to the past. I think it could have been a lot shorter and a lot less unpleasant, because it's really unpleasant, and I get that they're trying to make them have reasons why they have to go and change the past to be right, although really just changing it back to being right is a reason enough, but to have us all have to squirm
because your dad's dead
because Biff's in charge and he's awful, right? I mean, that's all it really takes. And yeah, it's kind of unpleasant. But you know what the good thing about this segment is? When it ends, this movie just goes into hyperdrive.
Yeah.
Once they get to the 50s, this is fantastic. This is my favorite. I would say this is my favorite segment of the Back to the Future franchise, is when they're playing around inside of the first movie, because I love the first movie, and this is what they've been setting up, and boy, it pays off. Even without Crispin Glover, so they have to use his footage from the first movie, I think that really works, because they seamlessly blend kind of the footage from the first movie with the second in a way that first scene didn't. And so the whole rest of the story takes place during the other movie. How
genius.
Great is that?
It is genius, and it's something that so many like cartoons and stuff have tried to touch on since, right? And you know, you've seen different ways that this has been done.
There have been other takes. Doctor Who has done a little bit of this, but this is just to take an iconic film and with many of the same actors a few years later, because they know it's already iconic, go back because it's a time travel story and be able to mess with it. I mean, it is a rare kind of thing to be able to do this, and they do it. For all my complaints about the first part of this movie, this part is just, it's so delightful.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's just spectacular.
Like, so great.
You know, when I talk about the technical achievement, this is it. Like, and the editing and all of the work that must have gone in to do this, it's really, really, really superb.
Yeah, the sound, and then you've got snatches of dialogue from the previous movie happening in the background. There's that scene where Marty is in the principal's office and he hears the, you know, hey, you get your damn hands off her from Crispin Glover from the first movie happening outside, and he turns around. There's a moment where Marty sees himself and he's like, whoa, this is so, you know, and Doc has the interaction where he hands the wrench to, or the screwdriver to, or the wrench to himself.
Yeah.
And it's just... That's all just great stuff.
Yeah. And I do love the scene in the principal's office. That's just a good scene, right? Where Marty's trying to hide and he gets his hand crushed and has to like silently scream.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that punching scene is outside of the window. It's woven back in so well.
Yeah, he goes over the top of the stage when he's playing Johnny B. Goode. I mean, literally he's crawling through the film as we go. It's amazing.
It's fantastic. And then they have a hoverboard and car chase again, right? Which is the final great final action set piece, which ends in Biff going into manure.
More manure.
And of course, you know, this is why I wrote down the most sequel-y sequel ever. And I just think it's perfect.
And so
for that.
And you've got the chance to do the time travel movie. What do you And again, I'm going to come back to Doctor Who, because the run, the current era of Doctor Who, with Stephen Moffat in charge, he's a very smart man who's been working in TV for a long time, and he's been a lifelong Doctor Who fan. And he has told, it's obvious he had a list that he built up over his lifetime of stories you could tell with time travel, all the different ways that time travel could be involved. And historically, Doctor Who was sort of, you take the time machine somewhere and have an adventure. But with Stephen Moffat, it's been adventures where the time machine is a part of the action. And I think about that because that's what happens in Back to the Future 2. And at the end, it's a super clever, great cliffhanger kind of moment that could only happen in a time travel franchise, which is, The DeLorean gets hit by lightning and disappears. And Marty is stranded in the 50s. And you wonder, oh my God, what's going to happen? What happened to Doc? And a car drives up and a guy gets out. And he gives him a letter. And he says, we've had this letter for 70 years. I'm from Western Union. And it's a letter from Doc from the Old West that's been waiting for him for 70 years. They said, they said you would be here. There's actually an episode of Doctor Who that's just like this. They said you would be here. We had a bet about it. And it's and Doc's in the past, but it doesn't change the cliffhanger, which is what happens now. And so he goes and then we get our final little. So that's a great little wrinkle. And then we get the final little moment where we play with the first movie, which is they go back. Marty goes back to the future at the end of the first movie. Doc is there to help when the lightning hits the clock tower. The fire trails are on the street. Doc is like, yes, I've sent Marty back to the future. And immediately Marty appears and goes, Doc, I need your help. And he goes, gah. So great. There's only one man who can help me now.
And it's Great Scott, right? Great Scott, great, and passes
right.
out.
Great Scott, and he passes out. But it's such a moment of like, how, I don't even know how you solve this. And the answer is you go talk to Doc. And that means that we end the movie, even though we've set up the sequel, the second sequel, we end the movie doing what the movie did best, which is play with something that we know very well from the first movie, which is that we've never seen Doc's perspective on what happens when Marty goes back to the future, right? Because we just go back with Marty. And now we get to see it. And it turns out what happens next to Doc is Marty from the future confronts him. That's great. So great.
But the other thing that I don't like is how much of the third movie they show at the end. Like, they spoil the entire movie by showing what's coming up next.
So it was unprecedented, essentially, to shoot these two sequels simultaneously. And now they do that all the time. I was just reading an article about the Hunger Games. You know, the Mockingjay Part 1 and 2 was all shot together and then released as two movies. Well, that's what they did with Back to the Future. And as a result, they had both scripts. They seeded it with all these hints about what was coming. But I think they were worried that people were going to be angry that it ends on a cliffhanger, even though I think it's really fulfilling as a film. But it ends on a cliffhanger. And they wanted to show people what they were going to do next just so that they... I mean, there's no dialogue, but they show a whole lot of stuff that's Old Westy. In hindsight, it could be less and give away less. I think they were really worried, and the studio was really worried about how people were going to go out of the theater. Are they going to give good word of mouth about this movie if there's no promise, you know, if it ends on a cliffhanger? So they wanted to give everybody like a glimpse of what the third movie would be like.
Yeah, and doesn't bother me that they did it. It's just how much they show. They show too much of the stuff that ends up being the cliffhanger. Like, you know, they kind of end up showing that there's like a way out for them. It ruins the movie. That, you know.
Yeah.
But it's
unfortunate.
I haven't seen Back to the Future Part 3 in a while. I need to go and watch that.
Yeah, we're gonna watch that too. That one was shot in my hometown.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Look
at the train in Back to the Future 3 is the Sierra Railroad, which is Jamestown, California, which is about 4 miles from where I grew up, and five. It's not a lot. Very short distance. It's in the Sonora area, and they built all that, the Old West set. It burned down like 15 years ago or something like that, but they built that Old West set out there because there's a little portion of the grasslands out there where the train runs by, and it's not really visible from the highway, and there are basically no structures visible, so it's a really good double for the Old West. So they shot it. They shot it there, and the whole cast and crew were in town for a couple of weeks, and then they shot a bunch of other like westerns on it until it burned down. They it was used again and again as an Old West set because they had it.
So I want to sum up and say that I continue to love this movie. Still one of my favorites. Every time I see it, I just continue to love it. This would be my favorite if it wasn't for that if the alternate 1985 wasn't so dystopian. That is something that really ruins it for me because it puts too much stress in a fun movie. And it wasn't, I didn't realize this until I watched it recently with Adina. It was her first time seeing it. And she said she just didn't like the movie at all because of that, because it really brought her down. And I hadn't seen it from that perspective before. And it might be why when I was younger, I always forgot that scene was in the movie. Maybe I was like blanking it out or something. But yeah, other than that, I actually do consider this to be a perfect movie. There is so much about it that I love in what I love about movies. I just think it does such a great job. And I'm really happy that we covered it today.
Yeah,
and I encourage everyone to, if they have listened to this, obviously I would expect a massive amount of people that are listening to this have seen this movie, go and watch it again. It's the right time to do it.
Yeah, it is. And what I would just say is I think half of this movie is incredibly good and half of it I could really live without. And fortunately, it's right down the middle. So watch the first part because it's got some amusing things to say about what 30 years ago thought 30 years from then would be, since we're living in it. The middle part is really dark and unpleasant, and then the last part is fantastic.